and welcome to the TNW podcast, the show in which we discuss the latest developments in the European technology ecosystem and feature occasional interviews with some of the most interesting people in the ecosystem. My name is Andriy Regular. I am the head of media at TNW.
And I'm Linnea Algren, senior editor at TNW.
Great to see you, Linnea. How are you doing?
Likewise. I'm good, thank you. Although, as I was just telling you, I just turned down a press invite for champagne and yachts in Monaco.
Oh my God. So you did not sell your journalistic integrity for an all-expenses-paid trip to a very nice location?
No, I did not. It was kind of tempting, I have to say. But I'll save that for another day.
That's great.
How are you doing, Andriy?
I'm very well. So, I mean, it's our beginning of the show is always about weather. So I will not...
you will not disappoint our
Yes,
listeners.
I will not disappoint our listeners indeed. So we had a great weekend in Amsterdam. We have an absolutely glorious 2 days, yeah, day and a half maybe of sun and warmth, which we definitely enjoyed to the fullest, being outside most of the time with the kids and everything. So yeah, feeling very good now, even though we are back to the normal programming with gray skies.
This is about the time of the year where our blackout curtains start to come into full effect. So I did enjoy the sunshine on Sunday morning, but then curtains came down and it was Baldur's Gate.
For the entire day?
The afternoon.
Okay.
Not ashamed.
Absolutely. I don't think you should regret anything in this regard. Absolutely not. Right. Let's move to today's episode. We have stuff to discuss, among which is a promising quantum breakthrough, a public funding disaster in Poland, the first Macintosh in Europe, and much more. You will also hear later on an interview with Jean-David Malo, the director of the Executive Agency for the European Innovation Council and Small and Medium Enterprises, also known as EISMEA. It's a long title, it's a mouthful, but you will understand every bit of it, I promise, if you listen to the conversation. Let's start with a story that we covered in the week that has ended. So, Linnea, what did jump at you? What did you pick?
So I'm going to talk about a potentially very significant breakthrough in quantum computing. It does come from tech giant Microsoft, but also from a company that began a startup out of Cambridge in the UK. But first, I think some quantum terminology refreshing is in order, because otherwise the story itself won't make much sense. So qubit, or quantum bit, which is what quantum computers use as information, it's analogous to a bit in classical computing, but there is a critical difference. So while a classical bit can be either 0 or 1, mm-hmm. a qubit can exist in a state that is a complex combination, also known as a superposition, of both 0 and 1 simultaneously.
I know this definition. I still struggle to understand how it works. But it also can be 0 or 1 or superposition. So it's
yes.
Like it has three positions.
So a quick analogy is, let's say you flip a coin,
mm-hmm.
and the coin will be either heads or tails, right? And as it's flipping through the air, it's switching between heads and tails. The qubit is both heads and tails simultaneously. In superposition. However, when you choose to look and measure mm-hmm. the qubit, it has to decide if it's going to be heads or tails. Andriy is nodding for those who do
I'm
not
just,
have
I'm just, I'm staring, I'm staring into the abyss and
into
nodding.
The quantum, into the quantum rabbit hole. It's okay. It takes a few times to hear it and to wrap your head around it, but then it becomes at least a little bit more graspable. But so what happens is that this then enables qubits to perform multiple calculations at once, because it can be mm-hmm. a 0 and a 1 at the same time. And this is what holds the promise of quantum computers. So eventually, the intention is that they will be able to solve incredibly complex problems much faster than classical computers. The catch is, now, as we mentioned, that as soon as you decide to look at the qubit, meaning you measure it, the qubit has to decide if it's going to be a 0 or 1. But the problem with today's quantum computers is that the qubits are very sensitive to what is called noise. And this has led to the period being what that we are now in being called NISQ, meaning noisy intermediate scale quantum.
Okay, that's a lot of stuff. But what is noise in this case? What causes the noise?
So noise in the case of quantum computers refers to internal and external interference that mm-hmm. lead to errors in quantum computations. Like, for instance, causing a qubit to lose the superposition quality. And this can be introduced by things like fluctuations in temperature, unwanted electromagnetic fields, or material impurities, or even just trying to measure the qubit, like we mentioned. So the next big step in quantum computing would be to build what is called a fault-tolerant quantum computer.
Right.
Now, a fault-tolerant quantum computer is designed to perform accurate quantum computation even when some of its components fail or make errors due to noise. Now, Quantinuum, which is the company that has been working with Microsoft in order to achieve this breakthrough that we're going to talk about, is the company that was formed in 2021 as a combination of the quantum hardware team from Honeywell Quantum Solutions and the quantum software team at Cambridge Quantum Computing. So in January, the company raised $300 million at a $5 billion valuation, and they have raised about $625 million in total to date. And just as a side note, quantum technologies was actually the one sector that increased in VC funding in 2023.
Right. Yeah.
Compared to 2022. I think it raised about $1.3 billion as opposed to the $800 million of the year prior.
Right. So it's not really a startup really anymore.
No, not anymore. No. No, absolutely no. No, Quantinuum is no longer a startup. But it did begin as one. So that's aspirational, I hope, for any quantum software startups out there. Anyway, Quantinuum has now worked together with Microsoft to hit what the two claim is a breakthrough on the path toward fault-tolerant quantum computing. And they claim to have demonstrated logical qubits with an error rate that is 800 times better than that of physical qubits. And this is a feat that was previously believed to be years away.
Okay, great for them. Congratulations. What is a logical qubit? And is it like a not real qubit? What does it mean?
So a logical qubit is like a coded peer support system among qubits.
That makes it so much more understandable.
It's formed by combining several physical qubits together using error-correcting codes.
So they work as one, basically, and self-correct.
Yes, precisely. They work as a unit. So this grouping allows the system to detect and correct errors without disturbing the quantum information that is stored within the system. So if one physical qubit in a logical qubit group gets sort of confused, meaning there is an error, the others in the group can help remind it of what it's supposed to be doing, which is based on the error correcting code. So this is where code obviously
that sounds is simple enough.
Incredibly important. So Microsoft and Quantinuum, they claim that by using Microsoft's qubit virtualization system and Quantinuum's ion-trapped quantum hardware, they have managed to perform 14,000 individual experiments without a single uncorrected error.
Wow.
So I said in the article that Microsoft was throwing billions into quantum computing technology. And while it is investing large sums, Microsoft also receives funding grants from the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency in the US, which is DARPA for short, for its Azure Quantum Initiative, which I find incredibly fascinating that we're now seeing more and more defense. I've talked about it before on the podcast, but that we're now seeing more and more national budget and defense spending going towards quantum technologies.
Yeah, but I mean, DARPA is also known for having been involved in a lot of technical breakthroughs in the 20th century, in the half and second half of it in particular, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting. Okay, so we have this whole thing. What does it mean for commercial applications? Is it going to be easier now to create quantum computers that actually can do stuff?
Well, so not immediately. Okay. No, there's not really any immediate effect, but however, this result is a necessary technological breakthrough on the path towards quantum utility. But this, we should say, only involved four logical qubits.
Okay.
And it would literally take hundreds of logical qubits to begin making actual scientific breakthroughs. And a quantum classical hybrid, say supercomputer, would need thousands of logical qubits to create actual commercial advantages further down the line. But still, this could actually be the moment where we first got like a proper glimpse beyond the NISQ horizon. And so if your mind is not entirely boggled by now, this is very exciting news. Actually.
Yeah, no, it does sound very, very exciting indeed. And I mean, scaling is one thing. So getting this breakthrough seems to be like more important in a way than also being able to scale it, right? Like scaling comes after being able to actually do this on a smaller scale.
Well, so the two are not, I wouldn't say that it's mutually sort of exclusive. Mm-hmm. I think that both things can happen at the same time, so that when you have the scale, let's say like IBM now is working towards 1,000 qubit system. So when you have that scale, you can then apply what you have learned from smaller scales instead of first developing fault tolerant codes and error corrections, etc., and then wait to scale after that. So I think what's really cool about the quantum ecosystem is that there are so many startups that are specializing in particular pieces of the puzzle.
Yeah.
And then these will all come together. And I think we're going to see a lot more of, for example, like the joining between Honeywell and Cambridge Quantum Systems. I think we're going to see a lot more of that, where different companies will join together to join their technologies together and then actually cause breakthroughs like this.
Yeah. Okay. I am going to bring us with the next story, the one that we didn't cover, for like very far away from the depths of research to a very hands-on topic, that is money.
Oh, well, I mean, that's something we all deal with on a daily basis.
Yes, and some seem to be more lucky than the others, unfortunately. So the story that I wanted to highlight today, it has to do with public money in particular and the dangers of taking the aforementioned money for startups. And it seems to be particularly an acute pain point in Poland these days, because there, dozens of startups are facing demands from the government to return grants that they received last year. And we're talking about grants anywhere in between hundreds of thousand euros to like millions of euros, like
that's,
million and something.
That's inconvenient.
That's very inconvenient. So here is the story. So the story was reported by our friends over at Sifted, and there are 38 startups right now whose grant contracts have been revoked and who now need to find ways to pay these hundreds of thousands of euros, if not millions, back to Poland's National Center of Research and Development, known as NCBR.
Wow, that's an email you don't want to receive.
No, not really. And just to be clear, so some of these companies have actually already received this money as grants. Some of them received the money as reimbursements of expenses that they made during their research and development process. And some of them have not received any money yet, but obviously have been expecting to receive them and made certain arrangements for the ways that they want to spend it. So it seems, however, that like these startups, at least some of them, in some of these cases, these drastic measures by the NCBR are totally disproportionate. At least several companies in question have said that their transgressions lie in literally inadvertently missing insurance underpayments of around 1,000 euros, all of which have been rectified promptly. But technically, it can be said, of course, that these startups gave the NCBR false information when they stated that they had no outstanding tax and insurance payments at the time they signed their grant contracts.
And forgive me if you mentioned this already, but how many companies did you say have received those grants?
So there are 38 companies, startups, that is, that are being told to return the money, and that's out of a total of 99 startups that received the grant in total. And I think there were also 18 bigger companies that cannot be counted as startups, but they were also part of this program. This money actually is provided by the European Union, and the program itself is called Fast Track Digital Innovation. And the program it aims to fund startups in fields of cybersecurity, digitization of industry, and digital creative technologies. That's the definition of what it's called. So basically, imagine over 1/3 of all companies, of all startups, that is, that received the grant are now being forced to give the money back.
Over a matter of bureaucracy, yeah, essentially.
In at least some cases, it's just like that. But I think most of the companies in question, they are saying that this is indeed their case. So, but there's a lot of context to it. This news comes actually after a very long string of issues with the program itself and the NCBR as an organization, which was repeatedly accused of corrupt practices in the way that the money was distributed in the first place. There are different regulatory bodies, I think both in Poland and on the European Commission level, which have launched several separate investigations into the center's work. So all these revoking of grants looks a bit like the NCBR is trying to show how it's diligent and serious and how it takes everything very seriously and working to double-check and triple-check all the documents and statements made by the grant applicants. Even though, in this case, it means bankruptcy for at least some of the startups that got the grants. So if you're interested in even more context, which does exist, there is much more to it, I will have a link to the reporting by Sifted in the show notes. But for now, just a couple of quick thoughts on this one from myself. First of all, breaking news. The finances of a startup could be, and often are, a bit messy. Okay, that's not to say that it's normal or that they should be encouraged or anything, but punishing a reporting discrepancy by demanding hundreds of thousands of euros back just doesn't seem fair. And as I said, according to the startups within this group of 38 companies, most of them fall into this category. So they just did something wrong in terms of reporting. Then they rectified the issues, but it was too late because the statement about not owing any money to the government were made at the time of contract signing. Then second part to it is that dealing with issues this way just defeats the purpose of the entire project in more than one way. First of all, it literally could lead to a decrease in the number of active startups in Poland due to the fact that some of them will just not survive after having to pay all the money. And the purpose of the program should be, I suppose, to actually create a great breeding ground for startups and increase them their number.
Yeah, that was my thought precisely, that this kind of measure like this sort of going against the entire raison d'être of the program to start with.
That's the whole thing. And also, interestingly, I read elsewhere that the NCBR is actually will be tasked in the coming years to disburse another like 8 billion euros, I think, on different programs, not only for startups, but in general. So it's not a great thing, which brings me to the second point that I wanted to make here, is that the situation works really to further decrease also the trust in public funding in the entrepreneurial community across the board. First of all, in Poland, of course, but also in general, because these stories are being discussed across the continent, like by us too. And at a time when the funding landscape for tech startups is already quite difficult, and European institutions are actually working hard to support tech startups to the best of their ability, having these kinds of issues is just incredibly detrimental to the image of the entire public funding effort. So my understanding is that at least some startups in question are going to appeal the decision of the NCBR. So there is still some hope there, but all in all, it's just not a good look.
No, and if you have been impacted by this in any way, please do reach out and let us know. We'd be really interested in hearing of what kind of communication there was around this and what kind of impact this has on your company.
Absolutely. Please do podcast at thenextweb.com. We are almost literally all ears. Okay, let's move to the learning of the week, Linnea. This week it's just you, but with some really interesting learning, which I literally don't know what you are going to talk about, because you didn't show me before the recording. You didn't share the actual topic, so... Go
no.
on, please.
Well, I did share the topic.
Okay, yeah, the topic, but not the finding.
Who do you think was the first person to own a Mac in at least in the UK, potentially in Europe?
A Mac, as in like a
the first Macintosh
desktop computer.
Yes.
In the UK. Could it have been someone from the royal family?
No.
I really don't know. Who was it?
It was Douglas Adams.
Oh.
So the author, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And I learned this sort of in a roundabout way. And I was like, maybe this is just a piece of sort of urban legend. But it turns out that the second person to own a Macintosh was his good friend, Stephen Fry.
Oh.
And they went to buy it together. And Stephen Fry has actually written about this on his personal blog, mm-hmm. on his official website. So I would say that's a first-hand account. And I unfortunately don't have Douglas Adams's account of what the experience of owning the first Macintosh was like. But I do have Stephen Fry's. And by the way, if you did not know, Stephen Fry reads the audiobook version of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and he does it brilliantly. So that's something that I would really recommend to anyone okay. who's into sci-fi.
I've never heard it.
To listen to. Really, it's fantastic. Yeah. So I'm going to read directly from Stephen Fry's blog. And he says that the first Macintosh had a monochrome display. The footprint of an A4 piece of paper offered 128K of RAM and a single disk slot. A new kind of a square stiff disk, not like the black cardboard floppy still being used in IBM, and the new wave of IBM-compatible machines that were exploiting Gates' licensing deal with IBM and running MS-DOS on their machines, which, whether IBM or not, relied on a phosphorus glow of green or orange text and the keyboard for inputting instructions. The difference was astounding. And the refusal of corporate systems and analysts to see that Macintosh was the way forward absolutely baffled me. I wasn't married to Steve Jobs. I had no shares in Apple. I just couldn't understand why people would sweat away at an ugly, inefficient, headache-inducing monster like an ICM PC when they could be writing books, publishing them even. By the end of the year, the Apple laser printer came out, opening up the world of desktop publishing and enjoying it. Yes, having fun and working at the same time. But it was not to be. We were sneered at, derided, told our devices were toys for people with too much money and not enough business sense.
That's quite delightful.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. Thank you so much for sharing
You're
this.
You're very welcome.
I wonder if there is also a version of Stephen Fry reading this. Does he read his blog posts?
If he records them. I don't know. This was from 2014. Hmm. I haven't been able to find it.
I can very easily imagine it's written
in his voice. He does read all of the books that he's written himself, mm-hmm. like on Troy and Greek heroes and mythology, etc. So
interesting.
But unfortunately, I haven't found a collection of blog posts. No,
but I can very easily imagine
him
reading
it. Yes, for sure.
It's also very very special writing style that he has.
Yes, indeed.
That's quite amazing. Right, and now we are going actually again back to a public money topic with our interview. I just keep bringing this up, right? I'm sorry. But it is time to move to today's featured interview, and it is with Jean-David Malo, director of the Executive Agency for EAC and SMEs, as I mentioned at the beginning. So usually we talk, when we talk about public funding in Europe, we talk about the first part of this agency's purview, which is the European Innovation Council. But in this conversation with Jean-David, I actually decided to take time and learn more about what else the agency is up to. So if you're actually interested in the EIC, you can always listen to our episode from 2 weeks ago and my interview with Michiel Scheffer. Then we covered the EIC itself. But today, let's hear about everything else this agency has to offer from Jean-David. Enjoy. Jean-David, thank you so much for joining the podcast.
Thank you very much.
So for those who don't know you all that well, can we talk a little bit about your own background and what you've been doing over the past 2-3 decades? What would be the best time frame to talk about in this case?
In fact, I joined the research and innovation community something like, almost 30 years ago.
Oh my God.
Oh my God, yes. I started in 1995 by leading, in fact, the European Affairs Directorate of the High School of Engineers in mm-hmm. France, which has a particularity, in fact, to have a number of labs that were already working in the context of the framework program for research right. and innovation. So I spent 5 years there. And then I pass on the other side. I pass a concours and I joined the European Commission in 2001, mm-hmm. where I made all my career until 2021 in DG Research and Innovation, where I have occupied several positions, starting in a legal unit, audit matters, moving quickly, in fact, to the assistance of one of our directors dealing mm-hmm. with the preparation of the European Research Council at that time, joint undertaking in the context of a partnership, research infrastructures. And then I moved in 2005 towards anything which is relating to the support and access to finance for startup and SMEs.
Right.
Starting with a financial instrument called the Risk Sharing Finance Facility, where I was head of sector. And then I grew up as head of unit dealing with this question with SMEs and state aid, and became director in 2015, dealing with open science and open innovation, with a kind of red backbone, mm-hmm. which was always the access to finance, in fact, for enterprise, and in particular startup and SMEs in the area of research and innovation. And as you know, I became the director of the EIC task force and the director of the EIC and SME executive agencies recently.
Right. Perfect. So, I mean, usually when we talk about the EIC, we end up talking about EIC Accelerator.
Indeed.
So what else is there? Let's just let's try to take a look at the entire thing that
you're
in charge of.
You are doing very well to start by saying this, Andrei, because I'm doing the same often. You're right. I mean, everybody talking about the EIC usually is talking about the accelerator. The accelerator is a very important part of the EIC, huh? But it's just one part of the EIC. The EIC is a single entry point program in tech,
right,
which has the purpose to support from the origination of an idea, so very low TRL, TRL 1, in mm-hmm. fact, the beginning of the idea, up to the support of the rapid scaling up of deep tech startup and SMEs, so beyond TRL 9. So the whole journey, which means that the EIC is also supporting advanced research, mm-hmm. Whereas the purpose here is really to support the emerging of new technology. We are on this... providing a support via a program which is called the Pathfinder,
right,
which is the successor, in fact, of the Future Emerging Technology Program, building on the strengths of the FET program, but adding another dimension, which is the scouting from the very start and during the implementation of the project on the potential use of any knowledge that is generated. This is why we have also... introduce new role in the way we are mm-hmm. monitoring project with the program managers, where they are, in fact, also managing together with a policy officer, policy and program project officer, managing the project in a portfolio approach mm-hmm. in order to create interconnection between the project
okay.
and try to use as far as possible and as quickly as possible the knowledge which is generated by this project. You have another dimension which is absolutely essential, which is one of the gaps that we would like to tackle with the EIC, which is a transition program, mm-hmm. which has the purpose to ease the move, the path from lab to fab. I mean, we mm-hmm. are generating great results of research, but we still have difficulty in Europe to transform, in fact, yeah. this knowledge, this result into a new product, new processes, maybe creation also of new companies. And the transition program has this purpose. And of course, the other main gap that we are trying to tackle is this rapid scaling up of companies that you have already mm-hmm. mentioned, which is the EIC Accelerator. So the EIC is a combination of the three. And if you allow me a last word, mm-hmm. for us, it's not sufficient. I mean, it's important to have these three pillars. But providing money is absolutely essential, but it's insufficient. We have also to provide all the services to our beneficiaries. It's important for them to be connected to the EU innovation ecosystem. So we are allowing them, in fact, to have access to large corporates, mm-hmm. To have access to public procurement buyers, to other investors, to international fairs. Like, for example, the CES
right.
In Vegas or GITEX in Dubai, to just to quote two outside Europe, but we could quote also a number within the Union, in Barcelona, in Berlin, in Paris, just to help them, in fact, to have also access to the other stakeholders of the ecosystem and to help them in their growth. So this is what we are calling our business acceleration services, where we are not acting in isolation. We have a number of partners and we are offering a portfolio of services to our beneficiaries.
Great. So you've been there at the very beginning of the Innovation Council. Now we are approaching the midterm review time. So how much has it changed from the vision that you had in the beginning until now?
Not so much, in fact. I mean, as you said, I was part of the small team at the beginning under the leadership of Commissioner Moedas and Director General Robert Jan Smits at that time, who launched, in fact, the idea. This was, of course, continued and also strongly supported by the successor of Commissioner Moedas, Commissioner Gabriel, and now Commissioner Ivanova, and successor of Robert Jan Smits, Jean-Éric Paquet, and notably now Marc Lemaître, also with Roberto Viola in DigiConnect. The initial vision is still there. The initial vision that we need to do much more in order to support new knowledge, transition, as well as the rapid scaling up of deep technology, in fact, in Europe to remain competitive, to remain leaders or to become leaders in the new markets that are created by this new race that we are living in the context of new technologies, is still there. Of course, you are learning by doing. So we are adjusting a little bit the way we are implementing the EIC. But what we see is that the demand is clearly there. We have a challenging success rate in our program, around 5% for the accelerator, around 7% for the Pathfinder. Not because we are not receiving excellent proposal, because we have not a sufficient budget. So, but what we see is that we have excellent proposal, which means that there is a need. We have in Europe great researchers, great entrepreneurs, great ideas. So we have all the necessary assets, in fact, to participate to the world competition. And it is even more important now that in the last 5 years, we have discovered, I should say, rediscovered that the world is tragic, that we had to secure our sovereignty, technologically speaking, economically speaking, that the competition is harsh, that we have to secure access to a number of materials, to a number of value chain. And in this context, the EIC is playing its role because it's typically a program which is dealing with technologies that are strategic for the future of the Union. So evolution, but reinforcing the relevance of the program.
Right. So you just mentioned that you're giving out as much money as you can, but there is still more excellent proposals that you receive. At the same time, what I've been hearing so far is that there will be less and less money invested through the EIC until the end of its lifetime, which is normal and to be expected. But is this something then that you would be pushing for to get more budgets, to get more money to be able to invest?
I mean, everybody would be pleased to have more money. I mean, I would not be the only one. Just maybe a small correction to what you say, which is right, but where it's important to explain why we have a decrease of the budget starting in 2024. In reality, the budget that has been allocated by the Parliament and the Council to the EIC for the period 2021-2027 is composed of two sources. Let's say the normal source, I will not enter into technical world, where in fact you have an increase over all over the time, year after year. But we had a top-up for the first 3 years in the context of the Next Generation EU. This top-up came to an end in 2023. So suddenly, it looks like a decrease of the budget. In reality, it's not. Right. Now, of course, it is perceived by the stakeholders of a decrease of the budget, because indeed, I mean, you have several hundred million less per year. You have seen the result of the midterm review discussion. So there will not be additional budget. Mm-hmm. There will be also a contribution from Horizon Europe to a number of policy priorities, in particular in the context of the Ukraine set of initiatives that are, I mean, not even something to be discussed. It's just a matter of priority. And in this context, of course, I mean, the EIC, like the other program, will suffer from this decrease of the support. Nevertheless, we remain with a very high budget, more than mm-hmm. 1 billion per year. It's not a small program. Of course, if you look at the needs, it's a drop in the ocean. But nevertheless, it is making a number of game-changing effects. When you look here in the EIC summit, the companies that are exposing, you can see that they are changing, in fact, the landscape in the area where they are intervening. So we hope that for the future, so the next multi-financial framework period, so post-2028, policymakers will continue to support the EIC mm-hmm. and maybe with even more means.
Right. Okay, so we don't have a lot of time, but just to wrap up this topic, can you and will you and are you considering doing more to rope in the private sector to get more investment? I know, pension funds, for example.
From the private sector, yeah. I mean, this is one of the, I will not say issue, challenge, I would say better than issue in Europe. We have, when you look at the origin of the support in particular, in the early or growth stage, also later stage, but mainly mm-hmm. in these two stages, and you compare it with the US, we have a totally different composition. Mm-hmm. I mean, the public part remains relatively important, even if it is a minority, but it remains important while it is almost absent in the mm-hmm. US. And you mentioned pension fund, you could add insurances.
Right.
You could add family offices.
Yes.
There are for these particular groups opportunities that we have to bring also to their attention. I'm thinking in particular of family offices. We have clearly now a number of examples of important family office funds which are looking for this kind of mm-hmm. investment because they would like to diversify the granularity and the typology of their investment. And this is good news. For the pension fund, it's another challenge. It's not linked in reality to an intrinsic aversion from the mm-hmm. pension fund. It's linked to a number of parameters, including the fact that in some countries, pension funds are not very developed because you have the welfare state provided yes. by the public sector, which is not exactly comparable to the US. Having said that, in a number of countries, you have some great initiative. I'm thinking in particular of what has been done in the Netherlands mm-hmm. In this context. And we see that gradually a number of pension funds are coming. Regarding insurance, it's another discussion we could talk about for a long time. But let's say that for insurances, the issue here is more a question of possibility of a good estimate of the possibility of return around a short or a mm-hmm. medium-term period. But we see there also some movement. So I will say that I am confident for the future on their involvement. But I do believe, like it was the case in the US, and I will conclude by this, that it's because initially you had the public fund support that gradually, in fact, the area became less risky mm-hmm. in the perception of these investors, and that the public support gradually diminished and even disappeared in a number of domains in the US. I do believe that the same evolution will take place in Europe. It will take a mm-hmm. bit more time. But the objective of our intervention, for example, in the EIC, is not to continue over several decades, but to create the condition for investors to have a better understanding of this particular segment, which are deep tech startup and SMEs with deep tech, which is not easy to assess for an investor. And thanks to this knowledge, to gradually take more risk and for the public means to disappear and to be reoriented to something else. What would be a perfect success?
Perfect. Thank you very much, Jean-David. Thanks a lot and good luck. We will return to this conversation in a year, I hope.
Thank you very much, André. Pleasure.
Thank you. Big thanks again to Jean-David Malo for finding the time to come on the show. This is all we have time for in this episode of the TNW podcast. Thank you all so much for listening. If you like our show, please help us spread the word. Tell a friend or colleague about the show and follow our updates on social media. Just search for The Next Web and you will find us pretty much everywhere. Our music and sound engineering is done by SoundPulse. Feel free to email us with any questions, suggestions, and opinions at podcast@thenextweb.com. I am André Degeler.
And I am Linnea Algen.
Have a great week, and we're going to talk to you next Wednesday.
Bye.
Bye.